content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the November 17th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. What was the American Revolution for? Amid plans to mark the nation's semi-quincentennial, many are asking whether or not the people really do rule and whether the law is still king, by Jill Lepore. This past June, at a No Kings rally outside a white clapboard church in a little brick town in the lower right-hand corner of Vermont, green mountaineers huddled together in raincoats under a pearl-gray sky. Some ironic anti-royalists wore golden paper crowns from Burger King, while some came dressed as orange and black butterflies, these being the only monarchs allowed in America. "Rejecting kings since 1776," read a sign carried by a woman wearing a rainbow bucket hat. In the matter of handmade placards, magic marker on cardboard, duct taped to wooden yardsticks, there was a certain amount of politico-literary one-upmanship. "Cry, my beloved country," was clever. But was "Make Orwell Fiction Again" cleverer? Abraham Lincoln was there, grim-faced and sepia, on a sign that read, "Government of the people, by the people, for the people." A red, white, and blue printed poster quoted Thomas Paine's Common Sense, "In America, the law is king." With or without the No Kings movement, the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution is, inevitably, an occasion to ask what the revolution meant, whether the people really do rule, and whether the law is still king. The Jubilee began in earnest in Lexington and Concord on April 19, 2025, the anniversary of the shot heard round the world, marking the start of the war. With an early morning battle reenactment and very tasty cider donuts, it will reach its peak on July 4, 2026, the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, with fireworks all over the country, plus hot dogs and bicycle races and pom-poms and drum majors. Between now and then, there will be exhibits and parades and lectures and picnics and protests and rallies, and one dearly hopes and prays, no more political violence, no more blood on the streets, no more shots fired. But in a year that has already seen multiple political assassinations, the deployment of the National Guard to American cities, and masked agents of the federal government hauling people off the streets and into unmarked vans, the prospects for a peaceful anniversary appear remote. A revolutionary year seems far likelier, and politically, that could go either way. Whatever you believe about the State of the Union, you might want to be careful what you wish for. As for history, and the story told about the American Revolution in museums and classrooms, on walking tours, and inescapably, once the marketing kicks in, on cereal boxes and highway billboards and cans of soda, the Trump administration has its version, and it wants that version to be everyone's version. But the problems with the federal government's interest in controlling the story of the American Revolution began long before Donald Trump was reelected. The U.S. Semi-Quincentennial Commission, a bipartisan body orchestrating the celebration, better known as America 250 or A250, was established in 2016 during Barack Obama's last year in office. Almost immediately, it descended into internecine war, and in the near decade since, its dysfunction has greatly impeded the ability of the rest of the country to get any planning done. This is measurable. Near the end of the Biden administration, A250 contracted with iCivics, a civics education organization founded by Sandra Day O'Connor, former Supreme Court Justice, to research activities planned around the country. These turned out to be very difficult even to discover, since, as the iCivics CEO told me, people are very underfunded and just really didn't have anything together by that point. That's still true. This summer, the partnerships that A250 had with several respected institutions, including iCivics, the Bill of Rights Institute, the National Cathedral, More Perfect, and the American Association for State and Local History, quietly ended. The commission, which is congressional, has struggled to maintain even a semblance of independence from the White House. In September, Ariel Abergel, a 25-year-old former Fox News producer who had been appointed by Trump to preside over the commission, posted on A250's official Instagram account, "America is in mourning. God bless Charlie Kirk." Days later, the commission fired him, citing serious and repeated breaches of authority and trust. Then came the government shutdown, which closed the doors of both the National Archives, postponing the October opening of its exhibit on the American story, and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, likely delaying the debut of its In Pursuit of Life, Liberty, and Happiness exhibit, slated for March. And both institutions, like every other museum with any relationship to the federal government, have been in the stranglehold of imperious demands from the White House, due, as we say, pressure from state governments is becoming increasingly common, too. There is no shortage of reasons that the celebration of the American Revolution has been, at least thus far, so half-assed. A lot of places began their planning for the 250th in 2020 in the aftermath of the 1619 Project, itself marking an anniversary, and during the George Floyd moment. Their plans therefore tilted in the direction of racial justice. But after Trump's victory in 2024, they were told they needed to tilt the other way. An early executive order denounced the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology abroad in the land and called for restoring truth and sanity to American history, under which the administration has sought to dictate what the American story is and who can tell it. Much federal funding now requires celebrating American greatness, military valor, and exceptionalism. In response, some local, state, and national organizations have simply refused to apply for it. John Dichtel, the head of the American Association for State and Local History, told me that people have said to him, "The money is tainted, and I can't take it no matter what." Others have fought back. After DOGE ended all National Endowment for the Humanities grants to state humanities councils in April, Oregon Humanities, joined by the Federation of State Humanities Councils, sued the federal government, arguing that the funds had been unlawfully revoked. The Oregon Council is using its reduced NEH money to hold a series of community conversations, especially in rural public libraries, trying to build bridges across the national political divide, under the heading Beyond 250. That's one of the better stories. Another is the work of the Bill of Rights Institute, which has partnered with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation to hold civics bees in schools all over the country. Whether you're a sixth grader or an eighth grader, when you're grounded in the documents and you're getting to the why questions and you're going deep about what it means to put these principles into practice, something profound can come of that, David Bob, the Institute's defiantly optimistic president, told me. But even Bob admits the scale of the problem. Civics teachers are afraid to teach civics, concerned about the government or about parents or both. Teachers feel very worried. We see it all the time. It's hard for them to go there to the contentious topics that they want to talk about and know they need to talk about. This is America at 250. Under the threat of censorship and other forms of menace, the Trump administration this year has so far fired the Archivist of the United States and the Librarian of Congress and has tried very hard to get the Smithsonian Institute to do its curatorial bidding. Some organizations have decided to do nothing at all, as if they could simply pretend that the nation was not about to celebrate the 250th anniversary of its birth. People are terrified, one art museum curator told me, not only about what to exhibit, but about what to write on labels. She says she keeps asking herself, should I just put the stuff on the wall and say, this was made in this period? Others are opting to uncelebrate and, instead, to denigrate the anniversary, following the logic of Nicole Hannah-Jones' original introduction to the 1619 Project, which cast the revolution as regrettable. One of the primary reasons the colonists decided to declare their independence from Britain was because they wanted to protect the institution of slavery, Hannah-Jones had written, a claim to which some prominent historians publicly objected, leading the New York Times to issue a partial correction, some of the colonists. One group of historians, for instance, is planning a panel discussion at an academic conference on whether it would be better to smear the revolution than to commemorate it. Even those cultural organizations, from historic houses to public school districts and universities, that have decided to do something for the 250th, appear to be doing considerably less than they did for the 200th. For the bicentennial, the Metropolitan Museum of Art staged a nearly 7,000-square-foot blockbuster exhibit on Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Critics may have found it tacky, but it became a hugely successful traveling show. For 2026, the Met is planning to display, in the American wing, 32 works from its own collection. One colleague of mine referred to putting on this exhibit as effectively staging a die-in. A frustrated curator told me that this modest scale is all the Met can do because look at the moment we're in. Another option is to try to capture this moment. The New York Public Library's bicentennial exhibit, The American Idea, displayed the Bay Songbook, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights. But for next year, the library is planning to ask visitors to reflect on the meaning of the anniversary and to archive their answers. In the 1970s, National Public Radio, with generous funding from the NEH, staged a year-long series of three-hour Saturday morning call-in programs called the American Issues Radio Forum. Given that the Trump administration has gutted the NEH, defunded NPR, and shut down the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, it's difficult to see how public media can mount anything as ambitious as was achieved a half century ago. A spokesman for NPR told me that its 250th agenda is still in the planning phase. A year these days is a lifetime. In 2024, the Declaration House in Philadelphia, a bicentennial-era reconstruction of the building where Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, installed The Descendants of Monticello, a hauntingly beautiful and provocative work by the artist Sonia Clark. Clark placed large video monitors behind the building's windows, turned outward toward the street, so that passers-by were met by the filmed and photographed eyes of the descendants of the people Jefferson enslaved, including his own descendants by way of Sally Hemings. Declaration House is part of Independence National Historical Park. Under the new regime, no Park Service site will be allowed to display any exhibit that does the essential work of scrutinizing the relationship between liberty and slavery in American history, or the relationship between Native nations and the federal government, because to do so is now considered advancing a corrosive ideology. The president's house site, built atop the foundations of the mansion where George Washington resided while in Philadelphia, has been asked to review panels describing the lives of nine people who lived there as Washington's property, owing to the administration's requirement that any displays that inappropriately disparage Americans past or living be removed. Under this logic, to note that Washington owned slaves is to disparage him, but to pretend that those nine people never existed comes at no cost to their memory. The hurdles facing museums and other institutions make it particularly impressive that many have already launched or are about to launch remarkably thoughtful 250th exhibits and activities. This month, History Colorado will open an NEH-funded exhibit called Moments That Made U.S., featuring artifacts that mark turning points in American history, including Nixon's tape recorder, the inkwell that Grant and Lee used to sign the surrender at Appomattox, one of the first copies of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, printed in Mexico, and some moon rocks brought to Earth on Apollo 11 in 1969. Jason Hansen, History Colorado's effervescent chief creative officer, told me that he thinks of the 250th as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to talk about what it means to be an American and what we want it to be going forward. He also thinks that it's easier to be sunny about the 250th outside the original 13 colonies, which he calls the OG 13. We are ready for an American history that doesn't always say, "The meaning of this event is this," Hansen told me. "We are having an argument in the country about the meaning of events." He's up for it. He's likewise excited about the state's plan to commemorate the nation's birthday, which is also Colorado's 150th birthday, by organizing teams to climb the state's 14ers, mountains taller than 14,000 feet. Back on the edge of the Atlantic, another early stunner is the Declaration's Journey, which opened on October 18th at Philadelphia's Museum of the American Revolution and traces the travels of these ideas in the Declaration of Independence across centuries and continents. "We tell the story of the Revolution all the time," the exhibit's curator, Philip Mead, told me. He said, "You know what they say about stories? There are two plots, a stranger comes to town or a man goes on a trip. We are telling these two stories here. The Declaration comes to town, the Declaration goes on a trip." The exhibit opens by way of prologue with two borrowed artifacts: the wooden Windsor chair in which Jefferson is believed to have written the Declaration, on loan from the American Philosophical Society, and a rusted metal prison bench, on loan from the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, from which Martin Luther King Jr. wrote his letter from a Birmingham jail. "The Declaration comes to town, the Declaration goes on a trip." My informal survey suggests that the eastern seaboard states are by far the most stressed out about the coming anniversary. Compared with the OG 13, the rest of the country is chill. Kansas City is getting ready for about 650,000 visitors at World Cup games next summer. On the 4th of July, the city's National World War I Museum and Memorial will light its 217-foot Liberty Memorial Tower after a Stars and Stripes picnic. Arizona is planning a traveling museum that will bring the state's most treasured historical artifacts to all 15 of its counties, setting them up in parks, schools, libraries, and civic centers. Its A250 commission, on which the Tohono O'odham Nation leader Verlon Jose served as the vice chair, is also using the occasion to tell the story of indigenous peoples and the West, and to celebrate Arizona's outdoors, including birding and fishing. We have Operation Freedom March, a veterans and military member relay along the Arizona Trail, the executive director of the commission told me. It runs from Mexico to Utah. People sign up to do it over the course of the year. You can walk, bike, run, horseback ride. sweating your way up and down a mountain, as opposed to, say, pondering General John Burgoyne's underestimation of the strength of the American forces in the Battle of Saratoga, seems an excellent way to mark the 250th, not least because, as Caroline Klibanoff, the head of an organization called Made by Us, told me, Gen Z does not care about this moment. She's leading a charge to youthify everything that's going on, finding a way to involve young people in the planning of what she calls Youth 250, and to use the anniversary to talk not about the past 250 years, but the next. Make this about the future rather than the past, is also the advice given by Sarah Jenks, a consultant who works with organizations all over the country, trying to help them figure out what to do for the 250th. The idea here, it seems, is to look to the future because the past is polarizing and the present is worse. Amid this American crisis arrives Ken Burns' six-part, 12-hour PBS documentary, The American Revolution, funded in part by the now-defunct Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The series, which is directed by Burns and his longtime collaborators Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt, and written by Jeffrey C. Ward, has much of the majestic scale, mournful tone, and somber feel of Burns' breakout 11.5-hour Civil War series from 1990, which both secured him a well-earned reputation as the nation's foremost documentary film historian and established a style in the representation of the past on television that has been so widely and often very poorly imitated that it has become at once inescapable and exhausted. What's so astonishing about the American Revolution is how it deploys what has long been called the Ken Burns effect to an altogether sharper end, something you can see in his deeply serious 2017 series, The Vietnam War, directed with Lynn Novick, which was something less gauzy than the Civil War, something as pointed as a bayonet. The new series is the best film out of Burns' shop and, I suspect, the hardest to make. What makes the American Revolution so singular and unfamiliar is neither its writing, Ward wrote for the Civil War and Vietnam War films too, nor its style. It features fiddly, moody, 18th century style music and pitch-perfect actors reading pithy, moving excerpts from 18th century letters. Mandy Patinkin as Benjamin Franklin, David Oyelowo as Olauda Equiano, Claire Danes as Abigail Adams. In place of the Matthew Brady photographs of the Civil War, the American Revolution lingers over 18th century oil on canvas portraits and more than 1,000 still images housed in archives, libraries, and museums, many of which presumably may not be on display in 2026 because of funding cuts and government censorship. The film's familiar visual vocabulary consists of slow pans over these images, alternating with more than 100 animated maps of battlefields, loving and exquisite footage of American landscapes, stone walls, cornfields, campfires, and scenes of anonymous reenactors marching and loading muskets and firing cannons, riding on horseback by moonlight, spinning and carting wool in pine-floored rooms, washing and wringing clothes by riverbanks. There are a lot of muddy boots and many guttering candles. Instead, what distinguishes the American Revolution is its fidelity to the best and most sophisticated scholarship, searing, challenging, and explosively interesting, especially as intellectual history. The Trump administration won't restore truth and sanity to American history, but this film does. Burns, who seldom takes political positions publicly, has spoken out against Trump since 2016. When he said that Trump belongs to a type that emerges everywhere and in all eras. Especially in his earlier films, Burns deferred to the storytelling of popular historians with mixed results. David McCullough narrated the Civil War, which chiefly featured Shelby Foote. And the most memorable talking head in baseball, produced in 1994, was Doris Kearns Goodwin. Much academic history suffers from pedantry and an almost willful irrelevance, but much popular history fails to tell you anything new or to ask you to confront anything difficult or unsettling, or, in Trump speak, anything inappropriately disparaging. The American Revolution relies on some terrific popular historians, including the journalist Rick Atkinson, who helpfully explains battle after battle. But Burns and his colleagues far more often rely on scholars, including Frederick Bear, Ned Blackhawk, Christopher L. Brown, Kathleen Duvall, and Alan Taylor, who appear on screen not to recount what happened, or not only that, but to explain what it means. They are fierce. What the American Revolution gave the United States was an actual idea of a moment of origin, which many other countries in the world don't have, Maya Jasanoff says in the documentary. The consequence, she continues, is that Americans have invested these particular years of these particular people with a set of stakes that are so far beyond what any set of events and any set of people can plausibly carry. Jasanoff, like four more of the film's chief storytellers, Vincent Brown, Philip DeLoria, Annette Gordon-Reed, and Jan Kaminsky, is a friend and colleague of mine. If one wants a national origin story that's clean and neat and tells you very clearly who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, Vincent Brown says, the American Revolution is not that story. The story that the American Revolution tells is of the emergence of the most important ideas of the modern world, fought over in a bloody and courageous rebellion against tyranny, which was at once a civil war and a global war, whose notions of freedom and slavery and conquest and independence tangled together the fates of British soldiers and American militiamen. Lenape diplomats and Seneca warriors, German mercenaries and French sailors, Akan men and Igbo women, backwoods pioneers and city ladies, the free and the unfree, the rich and the poor. It's a canvas, part Brugel, part Goya, a political carousel, a teeming, moving, terrifying story relating a chain of events forged of bravery and betrayal, of ferocity and torment, of ambition and terror, and yet a chain held together by the single organizing idea, as Kaminsky points out, of possibility, of a sense of living on the edge of a knife. Everybody on every side, including people who were denied even the ownership of themselves, had the sense of possibility worth fighting for. Throughout history, humans have been ruled by tyrants and armies without their consent. Americans fought for the freedom to rule themselves, and, more miraculously still, they won. Even after Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, King George III told Parliament that he remained determined to restore to my deluded subjects in America that happy and prosperous condition which they formerly derived from a due obedience to the laws. Parliament, though, voted to give up on America. As the wryly smiling Stephen Conway, a distinguished British military historian, observes in the PBS series Stirring Final Episode, the American Revolution changed the world. The series' achievement lies in honoring the dignity and meaning of the founding's revolutionary ideals and the sacrifices of all who fought for them, while taking an unsparing look at the war's cruelties and costs, especially for women, Black Americans, and Native nations denied the equality, liberty, and sovereignty the Revolution promised. The revolution that failed is the revolution the Trump administration cannot bear for Americans to know and mourn. The revolution that succeeded is the one some American institutions are determined to ignore. And maybe this is a balm or false comfort, But the American Revolution is also a reminder that this very division was a feature of the 18th century too, when there seemed to many observers to be so many different kinds of Americans that it was exceedingly difficult to believe that they could ever constitute a people. No army in history seemed ever to have been more ragged and motley and mongrel and polyglot than the Continental, rich and poor, learned and literate, from boys to old men, skilled and unskilled, born all over the world, speaking dozens of languages, believing in different gods and in no god. It beggared belief that they could fight as one and for no more than an idea. As a Hessian officer asked in his diary at the close of the war, who would have thought 100 years ago that out of this multitude of rabble would arise a people who could defy kings? A tragedy of this year, if admittedly a small one relative to what else is going wrong in the United States, is that the 250th will be a missed opportunity to wrestle with the meaning of the American Revolution and of the principles on which the nation was founded at a time when debating those ideas and confronting their implications are desperately needed. For better or worse, the No Kings movement and the opposition to it is where that debate is now happening. Revolutionary reenactment as political theater is scarcely new. Americans have been dressing up in three-cornered hats and knee breeches almost since the War for Independence ended, insisting that they, and not their political opponents, are the heirs of the Revolution. This has been true of the left, from suffragists to civil rights activists, and of the right, down to the Tea Party, that began during Obama's first term, protesting both the bank bailouts and the Affordable Care Act. That's what happens when a nation's founding document makes universal claims about self-evident truths and inalienable rights. Anyone can use those claims, and arguing over them is how American politics works. But the Declaration was also a secessionist document, establishing revolution as a right. Nations born in revolution frequently die in revolution. The United States is, in this case, very much an exception for having lasted as long as it has. The founding moment and this long history, what historians like to call the unfinished revolution, requires examination and argument at least every 50 years or so. Are the people still their own rulers? Is the law still king? Last month, as many as 7 million Americans gathered for another day of No Kings protest, or what congressional Republicans took to calling Hate America rallies. On Truth Social, the president posted an AI-generated video of himself wearing a gold crown and an Air Force jumpsuit, in a fighter jet emblazoned with King Trump on the side, flying over a generic downtown and dumping a payload of excrement onto No Kings protesters. I went back to that city in the lower right corner of Vermont. A man wearing a green hat carried a cardboard sign that read, Maple Syrup Makers for Sanity. Django Grace, a college sophomore in a blue Oxford shirt, spoke from a wooden gazebo, calling for common ground and common sense. I had not made a sign. I was there to report. But if I had, I'd have quoted not common sense, but Paine's lesser-known 1776 pamphlet, The American Crisis. After the war had begun, Paine, a volunteer in the Continental Army, indicted loyalists who continued to pledge themselves to King George. Let them call me rebel and welcome. I feel no concern from it, Paine wrote. But I should suffer the misery of devils, were I to make a whore of my soul by swearing allegiance to one whose character is that of a sottish, stupid, stubborn, worthless, brutish man. If it had fit, I'd wear it on a hat, except that I have a better hat. I got it at the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul 20 years ago, before all hell broke loose in this country. It's black and a little threadbare with a fraying brim, and it says, History Matters. Next, from the weekend essay of the November 9th, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, what did men do to deserve this? Changes in the economy and in the culture seem to have hit them hard. Scott Galloway believes that they need an aspirational vision of masculinity by Jessica Winter. Bald, white, and jacked, Scott Galloway is an action figure of the tech and finance overclass. He's an angel investor, a best-selling author, and a personal finance guru. He podcasts constantly. His hosting duties include the Prof. G. Pod, which offers business news takes and career advice, Pivot, in which he riffs on news of the day with the tech journalist Kara Swisher, and the self-explanatory Raging Moderates with the Fox News personality Jessica Tarlov. For someone of this Ubermensch milieu, he is surprisingly progressive and self-aware. He often acknowledges that his wealth and achievements were made likelier by his race, sex, publicly funded education, and devoted mother, who raised him mostly on her own. In recent years, Galloway has also become a leading evangelist for a notion that rapidly solidified into conventional wisdom. America's young men are in crisis. Seldom in recent memory has there been a cohort that's fallen farther faster, he writes in his new book, Notes on Being a Man. To make his case, Galloway pulls from a heavily circulated set of statistics. At colleges and universities nationwide, female students outnumber males by about 3-2. Among young adults, men are more likely than women to live with their parents. By their mid-30s, more than 15% of men still live with their folks, compared to less than 9% of women. Men die by suicide at about 3.5 times the rate that women do. Men's real wages are lower for the 10th and 50th percentiles of earners than they were in 1979. Currently, the unemployment rate among young men with bachelor's degrees between the ages of 23 and 30 is close to double that of their female peers. These numbers have roused bipartisan concern. In March, Governor Gavin Newsom of California, on the debut episode of his new podcast, welcomed the conservative influencer Charlie Kirk, who lamented Gen Z as the, quote, most alcohol-addicted, most drug-addicted, most suicidal, most depressed, most medicated generation in history, end quote. And these under 30s, Kirk said, were receiving a pernicious message. You're not going to have the same American dream that your parents would have. He and his fellow conservative organizers saw this as an opportunity, he added, especially with young men. Donald Trump won men under age 30 by 56% in the 2024 election, up 15 points from 2020. For these gains, Kirk credited the coalescing electoral power of the right-leaning constellation of podcasters and streamers known as the Manosphere, which encompasses libertarian bros, evangelical Christians, and white nationalists. Newsom, who is angling to become the next Democratic presidential nominee, appeared to be listening closely. At the end of July, he issued an executive order intended to confront California's growing crisis of connection and opportunity for men and boys. A week later, another likely Democratic contender, the former Chicago mayor Rahm Emanuel, published an op-ed in the Washington Post that linked unaffordable housing and health care to an increasingly despondent mood among young men. You don't have to be an incel to believe that the system is fundamentally broken and rigged against your success, Emanuel wrote. Like Newsom, Emanuel is doing what a certain kind of Democrat does best, triangulating. Both politicians have accepted at face value Kirk's premise. Young American men are in terrible and unprecedented straits, and those currents are yanking them rightward. But they want to steer the conversation away from demagoguery and misogynist sloganeering and toward a middle ground of respectful debate and technocratic fixes. Emanuel sees elixirs for young male malaise in the form of new zoning regulation and tax credits for first-time homeowners. But Emanuel does not see such promise in New York City's mayor-elect, the Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani, even though Mamdani's campaign focused relentlessly on affordability and, according to early exit polling, he won male voters between the ages of 18 to 29 by an astounding 40 points. When Emanuel wrote in the Wall Street Journal to criticize Mamdani's unabashedly leftist agenda, the letter was headlined, "My Party's Future Isn't Mamdani's New York." What some Democrats would prefer, it seems, is a centrist manosphere of their own. In Notes on Being a Man, Galloway, who has expressed bullishness on the presidential prospects of both Newsom and Emanuel, declares that discontented members of Gen Z and the boys and teens of Gen Alpha need an aspirational vision of masculinity, a vision opposed to the misogynist messaging that's epitomized by influencers such as Andrew Tate and Nick Fuentes. Part self-help memoir and part dudes rock polemic, the book presents a capital letter credo: men protect, provide, and procreate. Masculinity can be expressed simply by getting up at effing 6 in the morning and going to work and doing crappy work such that you can protect your family economically. Galloway once said, and the evolved man also ensures that he does not slack off domestically, emotionally, or logistically, leaving his partner to ask in Galloway's signature demotic, "Okay, boss, what the F are you bringing to the table?" The good man of the reasonable center, in Galloway's view, adheres to a code indistinguishable from that of the Boy Scouts: mental and physical fitness, emotional resilience, hard work, financial prudence, and caring for others. Few could object to any of this. But the person it describes, a kind and conscientious sort who aspires to make a decent living and who looks after their loved ones, seems blessedly gender-free. So why make this about manhood? Even the Boy Scouts have gone co-ed. There is no question that the generations-long erosion of the U.S. manufacturing base and the diminution of the unionized pension jobs that this sector had offered disproportionately harmed working-class men. This is perhaps especially true for black men, whose access to these steady, well-paying jobs greatly expanded following the victories of the civil rights movement. Ongoing industrial collapse has shaped many of the statistics that are central to the man crisis discourse. Yet, if you tilt some of the most commonly cited data points this way or that, you can just as easily argue on the behalf of a woman crisis as a man crisis, or perhaps most accurately, for an ongoing multidirectional crisis affecting us all. The college gender gap, for instance, could be evidence of a rudderless, demoralized generation of young men, but it might also be the product of differing economic incentives. A paper published last year by Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce examines the labor landscape of rural America, noting that women need more education to earn the same amount of money as men, and that the less education a worker has, the more this gender gap widens. The overall trajectory for the lowest earning men is not good, certainly, but it's not clear that their female counterparts are faring better. The suicide gender gap, for another example, is actually narrowing. In 2007, it was 5-1, and young women attempt suicide more often than young men do. Women's wages, overall, are still 17% lower than men's, partly because women are vastly overrepresented in many relatively underpaid provinces of healthcare and social services. And this asymmetry helps to explain the unemployment gender gap among younger adults. Healthcare is the source of most labor force growth in the U.S., and it's women who are taking most of those jobs. Even so, unemployment among black women is up, partly because they were overrepresented in federal agencies that were decimated by DOGE, and labor force participation among women with children is down, possibly because of rising child care costs and the kinds of strict return-to-office policies endorsed by the Trump administration. Among the more practical proposals to have emerged from the man crisis discourse is that the U.S. should mount a campaign to recruit more young men to so-called heel jobs. The acronym stands for Health Education Administration and Literacy. The teaching and nursing professions are facing serious labor shortages. These jobs don't come with big paychecks and are often grueling, but they're also resistant to automation and relatively recession-proof. In the best-selling Of Boys and Men, published in 2022, the social scientist Richard V. Reeves writes, "We need to break the cycle of professions taught by women for women. Some robust affirmative action is justified here." The Economist and former New York Times columnist Paul Krugman has recently taken up Reeves' refrain, writing on his Substack, "Many of these occupations are female-coded and have become more so over time, partly because they're underpaid. But they don't have to be. We can help attract men into these occupations in part by increasing the wages heel occupations pay." Women, it should be noted, have dominated the teaching profession since the 19th century, not because it's a misandrist job protection racket, but because early public education advocates found that they could expand the school system more quickly by hiring women teachers whom they could pay less than men. One might ask, if difficult, essential work might be well paid at this moment in history, regardless of a person's sex. But then, much of the centrist Manafeer's rhetoric is predicated on refusing to see half of what's in front of you. Newsom's executive order concerning men and boys acknowledges the strong correlation between social media usage and mental health disorders such as depression and anxiety. But it doesn't note that these effects manifest in girls at significantly higher rates. In Notes on Being a Man, Galloway writes, "The deliberate transfer of wealth from the young to the old in the United States over the past century has led to unaffordable and indefensible costs for education and housing and skyrocketing student debt, all of which directly affect young men." He could have said young people, unless college bursars and landlords run a discount program for the ladies, which I haven't heard about. Emmanuel, in his Washington Post op-ed, endorses a double standard with even greater frankness. "The cost of housing," he writes, "is of course a problem for all Americans, men and women alike, but unpopular as it might be to say in some quarters of my party, the crisis affects one gender with particular potency." In other words, men and women pay the same bill, but we are obligated to understand that the social and spiritual price it extracts from men is higher. If women want an emergency to call their own, it can be that they are not having enough babies. The ambassadors of the centrist manosphere praise women's advancement and the feminist cause while insisting that men's economic and vocational anxieties are more naturally potent. This ambivalence reveals the weakness of their side. The right-wing manosphere knows that masculinity is a series of dominance signals beamed from behind iridescent Oakleys and the wheel of the most enormous pickup truck you've ever seen. It is a smirking multimillionaire who destroys a young woman at a college-hosted debate. It is, must it be said, an AR-15 openly carried. Manliness in the Trump era, Susan Faludi has written, is defined by display value, which exhibits itself in a pantomime of aggrieved aggression. Upon this stage, men's biggest problem is feminism, and the solutions are straightforward. Restrict reproductive rights, propagandize about traditional gender roles, etc. The squishier centrist side has no such certainties. Galloway, in both his podcast and Notes on Being a Man, presents masculinity not as one side of a fixed binary, but as a state of mind and a lifestyle, one equally available to men and women, and therefore impossible to define. Within this amorphous framework, men's biggest problem is, likewise a feeling, an unreachable itch or a marrow deep belief that men should still rank above women in the social hierarchy, just not as much as before. This belief may be misguided or unconscious, but it is nonetheless insuperable, and it must be accommodated for the good of us all. What these pundits are nudging us to do, ever so politely, is accept that women, in the main, are accustomed to being a little degraded, a little underpaid, and ignored and dampened in their ambitions in ways that men are not and never will be. The female-coded person, to borrow Krugman's terminology, may feel overwhelmed by child care costs, ashamed that she can't acquire a mortgage, or hollowed out by long hours as an ICU nurse. But such feelings do not disturb the order of the universe. This person's duties to protect, provide, and procreate are real, but they do not take the capital P. This person's opinions matter, but not decisively. The New York Times pundit Ezra Klein has lately suggested that Democrats consider running anti-abortion candidates in red states, even though more than three-quarters of Gen Z women support abortion rights. Rights, like jobs, can be gender-coded, and these rights are valued accordingly. "You need dad," Galloway, who has two sons, said on a recent podcast. The nuclear family, he imagines, seems to be one in which the mom is the default partner. "They look to her for nurturing. When they really have a problem, I find they go to mom." While the necessary dad is the authority figure to whom mom can appeal as the occasion demands. "There are certain moments when my partner needs me to weigh in," Galloway explained. "I don't know if it's the depth of my voice, my physical size." Boys, he went on, begin tuning out their mom over time. One might wonder how boys lose these frequencies in the first place. One might long for a deep voice to explain it. The notion that fathers wander away from their families owing to some gnawing sense of existential dislocation, some humiliating certainty of their own uselessness or usurpation, is especially pungent when one takes into account the enormous gender gap in housework and childrearing in heterosexual marriages. According to the Gender Equity Policy Institute, mothers who work full-time do almost twice as much household labor as fathers. Research by the Nobel-winning economist Claudia Golden has suggested that married men's disinclination toward housework and other draggy business of family life may be holding back birth rates, which should pique the interest of Republican pronatalists such as J.D. Vance. The deeper one sinks into our nation's alleged man-boy problem and its potential solutions, the more the woman reader may begin to feel something stronger than resentment or intellectual disdain. She may begin to feel a chauvinistic gratitude in her sex. The familiar flatness of feeling a little degraded seems preferable to the anger, entitlement, and alienation that, we are told over and over, gnaws away at so many male specimens. What a gift it is, really, to have no choice in the matter, to have to move out of your parents' house to show up for your shift to change the diaper, not because any of it is gender-affirming, but because life is full of tasks that need doing and you are the person who does them. At least then you know who you are. Reading Galloway, one gets the sense that men last knew who they were about 75 years ago, much as the Trump administration does when it vows to revive the coal industry or when it shares fascist-like iconography that would be at home in a Paul Verhoeven film. Galloway appeals to the reader's nostalgia for mid-century peak male. It was young men, he reminds us, who stormed the beaches at Normandy and who won the Battle of the Bulge. When Germans or Russians are streaming over the border or firing from the beach, big dick energy isn't just a nice idea, it's effing mandatory. Of course, the German soldiers were young men too. And it is not clear which border Galloway thinks the Russians were crossing, or if he realizes which side they were fighting for. Galloway also singles out two monumental building projects of the Great Depression as bygone proof of men's capacity for collective effort, incredible bravery, risk-taking, aggression, and sacrifice. One was the construction of the Hoover Dam, during which, Galloway points out, scores of laborers died of heat exhaustion or carbon monoxide poisoning. The other was the Empire State Building. Construction began in 1930 and ended a year later under budget and ahead of schedule. He does not add that the skyscraper went up so fast and so cheaply, in part because New York City was filled with men who would work for next to nothing under grueling, even lethal conditions, because the implosion of global capital had buried wages and organized labor beneath it. Perhaps these dire conditions only burnish the men's heroism. By coincidence, Notes on Being a Man is being published in the same month as Glenn Kurtz's Men at Work, The Empire State Building and the Untold Story of the Craftsmen Who Built It, which adds biographical details and dimensions to Lewis Hine's heroic photographs of the skyscraper's construction process. Most of the names of these laborers are not known, at least in part because they were seen not as men but as hands, Kurtz writes, as something less than complete people, or at best as embodiments of generalities and abstract ideals, such as those espoused in Galloway's book. For all we know, these men too felt that the system was fundamentally broken and rigged against them. But they are long dead and largely anonymous, and so they can be whoever we want them to be. Kurtz unearths what he can of their lives, and he finds plenty of evidence of what today we might call men in crisis, deaths of despair, dislocation, and broken families, dependency. A carpenter named Finn Eglund, who was 30 years old, either jumped or fell from the Empire State Building as construction was wrapping up. His death was ruled a suicide. Another carpenter, Matthew McKean, had abandoned his wife and two children back in their home country of Scotland. And a stone setter in his 20s named James Carr was still living with his mother. And as usual, I'll end with a poem, this one from the November 10th, 2025 issue. The World Was All Before Them by Maya C. Popa. I wasn't fooled by these walls of my body, but love them touched. Like a seed that germinates in fire, shy, slide of pressure, tally of cries. I am my first and oldest system, a figment of that first imagination set running, but I concede to your vision. That look you give me like nothing other than my throat will do. Your affair with my ankles is lesion, an emperor thumbing his ostrich plumes, a moon drawn down with string to delay a debt. You have made me an Eden, the veins of my wrist, the twin rivers of heaven, an altar where neck meets spine, Eden, by which I mean you will leave me. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.